This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement.
Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Due to the graphic nature of this cult's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of organized hate and violence, including gun violence, that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under the age of 13.
The crowd cheered as the knights took their places at either side of the arena. A signal from their lord, and the jousters spurred their horses forward, lances leveled.
One jouster hit his adversary's shield right at the center. The other managed a perfect blow to his opponent's chest, unseating him. The crowd roared their approval.
With this blow, the match concluded. The Lord bestowed praise on the victor, and his banner was displayed for all to see.
When the joust was over, the enthused audience poured out of the arena. The end of the match meant it was time to return to ordinary day-to-day life. And that meant hours upon hours of drills.
The audience-turned trainees filed onto the shooting range. With handguns and sniper rifles, each young man took aim and fired at his target, a photograph of the Pope taped to a bullseye.
These people weren't medieval peasants, and this wasn't Dark Ages Europe. They were members of tradition, family, property, and they were committed to return the world to the glory days of the Middle Ages.
They trained constantly for the imminent apocalypse and the rise of an Antichrist.
Hi, I'm Greg Polson.
And I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And this is Cults, a Parcast original. Every Tuesday, we look at a cult's practices, their leader, and their followers. You can find all episodes of Cults and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. To stream Cults for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Cults in the search bar.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into Tradition Family Property, a right-wing paramilitary group founded by Brazilian theologian Plínio Corrêa de Oliveira. This week, we'll discuss Oliveira's early life and the culture shift that led him to believe the end was nigh. We'll also discuss some of his beliefs, including his certainty that the Middle Ages were the epitome of human achievement.
Next week, we'll explore day-to-day life in Tradition Family Property. We'll also lay out some of TFP's most controversial modern initiatives and discuss how the cult functions today.
To Plinio Cojeira de Oliveira's beliefs were consistent for his entire life. The same ideals that led him to eventually found Tradition Family Property were instilled in him from a very young age.
Oliveira was born on December 13, 1908, in Sao Paulo, Brazil. His father was an accomplished lawyer, while his mother came from a highly respected old money family. Thanks to their resources, the Oliveira family enjoyed a level of wealth and stability that wasn't available to the average turn-of-the-century Brazilian.
In his early years, Oliveira and his family took frequent trips to Europe. This was in part so his mother could seek medical treatments for a chronic illness that she couldn't properly treat in her home country.
As a young boy, Oliveira was entranced with European culture and values. He particularly loved their long and storied history and developed a lifelong fascination with medieval society. He saw himself with his noble lineage as a spiritual heir to the glories of Europe's past.
Oliveira's wealth and family line shaped his childhood values, but he was considerably more ordinary in terms of his religious background. Like the vast majority of all Brazilian people in the 19th and early 20th centuries, Oliveira was raised Roman Catholic, but his unusual level of devotion shaped him into the man he'd become.
Vanessa's going to take over the psychology from here. Please note, Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but she has done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Greg. Psychotherapist and author Eric Maisel found a strong link between religion and authoritarian attitudes. Because the Catholic Church and other religious organizations tend to be structured around a strict hierarchy, devout people tend to internalize the notion that moral devotion and submission to authority are one and the same. In turn, many authoritarians find a comfortable home in religious circles.
Oliveira didn't see Catholicism as a Sunday morning only institution. He tried to incorporate his beliefs into his everyday life. In Oliveira's mind, if he wasn't utterly devoted to heavenly things in all ways, then he wasn't living his life in the way God intended.
To further his religious development, when he was a teenager, Oliveira enrolled at Colégio São Luís of the Jesuit Fathers, a private Catholic school.
The institution was popular among upper-class Brazilians who couldn't afford the steep tuition and reap the educational benefits that came with it. And it was there, as he matured and learned about the world around him, that Oliveira began to genuinely fear for the state of Christianity worldwide.
Throughout the Western world, traditional Catholic teachings were on a downswing. This was in part due to the spread of Marxism throughout Europe and Latin America.
Many communist revolutionaries saw churches as threatening to economic equality. And as the Soviet Union and China joined the Red Wave, Christians and other religious people were persecuted.
In the Soviet Union alone, nearly 8 million innocent civilians died in the early days of communist rule. Priests and nuns were often tortured to death, while ordinary lay people were arrested, sent to work camps, or executed for their religious beliefs.
As news of these injustices spread throughout the world, many feared that anti-Christian persecution would become the norm in other communist countries.
But the church wasn't going to take its loss of cultural primacy lying down. Pockets of devout people grabbed headlines and courted converts through tent revival meetings and traveling evangelistic preachers.
The early 20th century also marked a period of time in which the Catholic Church in particular began to witness many signs and miracles.
In Fatima, Portugal, in 1917, a 9-year-old shepherd girl named Lucia Abóbora and her younger cousins, Jacinta Marto and Fernando Marto, reportedly received a series of visitations from the Virgin Mary over the course of 6 months. Their sightings came to be known as the Miracle of Fatima.
Through most of the early 20th century, many bodies of saints were disinterred and found to exhibit no signs of decay. Even when scientists ruled out natural mummification processes, the corpses of saints Margaret of Savoy, Zita, and Savina Petrilli were all found to seemingly resist decomposition. The church declared that this was a sign of God's approval and blessing.
In 1922, a devout Catholic named Teresa Neumann claimed that she was able to survive without eating. She subsisted solely on the Holy Communion.
4 years later, in 1926, she began to exhibit stigmata, or the sudden appearance of nail marks on her hands and feet, in the same place as Jesus Christ was injured at his crucifixion. This, too, was recognized as a miracle.
Many felt skeptical of claims of divine intervention. Advancing scientific knowledge provided a persuasive counter-explanation. Nevertheless, the Vatican issued hundreds of decrees regarding miracles from the late 19th century through the early 2000s.
While the Church claimed that these many instances were examples of God's direct hand upon the earth, secular speakers attributed these sightings to misinterpretations of ordinary phenomena, or hysteria, and many more were ruled out as hoaxes.
Psychologist and theologian J. Harold Ellens noted in his book Miracles, God, Science, and Psychology in the Paranormal that some people feel like they can improve social bonds and their own standing in a community by faking miracles. Even without a desire to advance a particular religious viewpoint, fakers can reap respect, fame, and stronger ties to their community when they claim they've experienced or witnessed an act of God.
But in Oliveira's mind, it was unacceptable to even consider that miracles could be fraudulent. Instead, by carefully studying the Bible, he tried to discern their real meaning.
Researcher and psychologist Saul McLeod explained the importance of social identity, the tendency for a person to define themselves by the groups they belong to, whether a person's self-image is tied to a favorite sports team, nationality, or religious affiliation. People relate so strongly to their communities that they see threats to the organization as a danger to themselves.
As a wealthy and well-connected young man, Oliveira had little to fear from anti-Christian persecutions a world away. But he identified so closely with his Catholicism that reports of spreading secularism felt like a personal attack. And just as his Catholic identity led to feelings of insecurity, he also found a way to contextualize the threats and comfort himself using the Church's teachings.
Because of his vigilance and knowledge of biblical prophecy, Oliveira concluded that he knew the hidden truth of the changes that swept the world, the threats to Christian supremacy, and corresponding signs and miracles had all been foretold long ago. And by correctly identifying these trends, Oliveira concluded that he was living in the end times. As far as he was concerned, he was waging a war with Satan.
Next, Oliveira tries to prepare for the coming apocalypse by reforming the Catholic Church.
Now, back to the story.
Wealthy, devout Catholic Plínio Cojeira de Oliveira grew up in Brazil in the early 20th century. But by the time he was a teenager in the mid-1920s, he felt increasingly uneasy at the spread of secular thought throughout the world. This led him to conclude that the end of the world was nigh. These fears stemmed from his own unique interpretation of the Book of Revelation.
The final book of the Christian Bible, called St. John's Apocalypse, or the Book of Revelation, has been hotly debated in theological circles for two millennia. The account has sometimes been interpreted as a highly symbolic history of the early church.
Another theory states that Revelation is a series of coded transmissions penned when first-century Christians were persecuted in Rome. This suggests that the inscrutable imagery allowed the early church to criticize their oppressors without officials ever realizing the book's real meaning.
But one popular interpretation for Catholics and Protestants alike suggests that Revelation predicts and describes the end of the world. This was Oliveira's understanding of the book.
According to this framework, in the end times, God will enact a bloody and violent judgment upon all the people of the world, with particularly severe punishments reserved for non-believers. A period of intense suffering and mass death will culminate in the second coming of Jesus Christ and a new utopian Christian era.
Most religious traditions feature some kind of discussion of the end of the world, but not all religious people are overly concerned with a looming apocalypse. Social psychologist Daniel Sullivan noted that people who experience a lack of control over their own lives tend to become more fervent in their belief in end times prophecies.
In other words, Olivera's conclusion that the end was nigh was quite natural and expected, especially in light of his strong identification with the global Christian church. His apocalyptic beliefs gave him a comforting narrative to explain the changing world around him.
But that belief system went on to warp his future actions and ideology. A study on apocalyptic religions conducted by social psychologists Leon Festinger, Henry Reakin, and Stanley Schachter found that belief in end times prophecy requires a certain level of cognitive dissonance. When a person fervently believes the world will soon end, but then life continues unabated, that person will actually believe more fervently in a looming apocalypse, even after their predictions fail to come true. According to the University of Washington, occasional instances of disassociation are common, even for mentally healthy people. But repeated or ongoing dissociative episodes can impede a person's critical thinking ability and lead to dangerous and risk-taking behavior.
In Olivera's case, he was a fervent believer through his teen years, and his certainty that the world would soon end led him to commit all the more to the Catholic Church. He resolved to never date or marry, but instead to throw himself headfirst into his work to save his religion from the threat of secularism.
After graduation from the Colegio São Luís of the Jesuit Fathers, Olivera had his pick of universities, thanks to his wealth and social connections. He opted to study law at Faculdade Jesuíta, from which he graduated in 1930.
During his college years, he served as a member of the Marian Congregations of São Paulo, a nationalist Catholic activist group. There, he quickly rose through the ranks into a leadership position, which gives us insight into who Olivera was.
Professor Peter Harms and psychological researcher Emily Grijalva studied psychological traits that correlated strongly with personal success. They found that people with an obsession with their own self-image were more likely to attain leadership positions than other people. Former FBI agent Joe Navarro adds that the same self-obsession correlates strongly with cult leadership.
Olivera's service with the Marian congregations granted him access to high-ranking Catholic officials in Brazil, and he was able to leverage them to adopt policies that reflected Olivera's own religious values.
In the early 1930s, Olivera determined that the best way for the Catholic Church to maintain its power and influence was to elect Catholic-friendly candidates into government positions. He worked with Duarte Leopoldo e Silva, the Archbishop of São Paulo, to help spur Catholic voters into a unified bloc.
Olivera worked with Catholic militants and casual churchgoers alike to found the Catholic Electoral League in 1932. Thanks to his efforts to establish the organization, 24-year-old Olivera soon secured a position as secretary of the São Paulo branch.
On May 3, 1933, Olivera's star only shone brighter when, thanks to the support of the Catholic Electoral League, the 25-year-old won a seat on the Third National Constitution Assembly of Brazil, a federal legislative body. There, he did his best to shape Brazil's laws to better reflect his own perceptions of what a Catholic-friendly nation should be.
Olivera's campaigning ensured that Brazilian public schools retained the legal right to teach Christian theology. It also granted missionaries access to federal inmates and soldiers for evangelism. He also fought to preserve references to God in the national constitution. When he was accused of putting his personal values above the good of the state, Olivera countered, "I prize my religious beliefs above any possible affection."
As Olivera established himself as a government official, he also continued to make inroads with church authorities. In 1933, the same year he won his election, Olivera also became editor of the Catholic journal, O Legionario. The Cardinal of São Paulo personally endorsed him for the position.
Olivera's publication cemented him as a leader of Catholic thought. Within a decade, O Legionario's circulation increased until it was a major nationwide paper, Soon, Oliveira was inextricably linked to the Brazilian Catholic Church.
As he gained social standing and political power, he continued to advance his beliefs through publications. From 1943 to 1951, Plínio Corrêa de Oliveira penned three books. His texts promoted conservatism and condemned communism and progressivism. He also published countless articles and op-eds.
He decried changing political trends and called for his readers to return to their traditional religious roots. As fascism arose in Germany, Oliveira wrote that Nazism and communism were equally dire threats to the spread of Catholicism.
He determined that devotion to aestheticism and efforts to promote piety within the secular world were the only appropriate political stances for Catholics. As he wrote in the January 1939 issue of O Legionario, Catholics should be anti-communist, anti-Nazi, anti-liberal, anti-socialist, and anti-Masonic, etc., simply because they are Catholics.
By 1951, 42-year-old Oliveira secured a job writing for Catolicismo. In this conservative newsletter, Oliveira regularly penned missives and musings on the issues that most plagued the church.
It was also through these columns that Oliveira established and worked out his core beliefs. He saw the spread of secular thought as inherently threatening to Catholic devotion, and he saw Marxism as inextricably linked to secularism, so he regularly condemned any trends towards socialism.
But Oliveira took his arguments one step further than that. Because Marxism was, at its core, a pro-equality movement, Oliveira saw any efforts to advance civil rights as antithetical to Christian thought.
Oliveira decried the evils of women's suffrage, racial equality, and even the spread of democracy. He fingered Protestantism with its theological tenet that man could pray directly to God without a priest as an intermediary as one more threat to his Christian values.
In Oliveira's mind, all devoted Christians had an obligation to reject progressivism. The church needed to return to its roots, traveling back to a time before feminism, before unions and workers' rights, even before the Protestant Reformation.
The church's golden era and the highest pinnacle of human achievement, according to Oliveira, were the Middle Ages. To him, it was a period that embodied all that the modern church should strive to be.
As he wrote, medieval Christendom was not just any order or merely one of many possible orders. It was the realization, in the circumstances inherent to the times and places, of the only authentic order among men, namely Christian civilization.
Psychologist and writer Christine Baccio found that people tend to feel particularly nostalgic during times of transition or instability. It's not unusual to idealize eras long before a person was even born. When Oliveira saw what he believed to be dire threats to Christian supremacy, he naturally longed for a period when Catholicism was the unquestioned power in the Western world. His close personal identification with the Catholic Church surely exacerbated this nostalgia.
As his publications spread, Oliveira found plenty of like-minded supporters. But for every ally or sympathizer Oliveira was able to reach, he seemed to encounter even more Catholics who opposed Oliveira's teachings.
In fact, despite Oliveira's best efforts, the Catholic Church seemed to be inevitably marching down an ever-progressive path.
Oliveira especially felt threatened by an increasingly popular movement called liberation theology. This doctrine emphasized the rights and needs of disadvantaged people, including the poor and oppressed. It emphasized social justice as being the heart of righteous behavior.
Liberation theology began in 1950s Latin America, a product of the same forces that drove Oliveira to militant conservatism. But this movement sought to spur devout Catholics to care for the poor and advocate for equal rights. In Oliveira's mind, this was a dire affront to God.
Pope John XXIII was an adherent of liberation theology, after he noted how the Catholic Church's old-fashioned policies alienated as many people as it enticed or converted.
he and other high-ranking church officials recognized that if the church didn't want to be perceived as out of touch with modern science, philosophy, or an increasingly diverse world, the Holy See needed to adapt to a modernizing society.
In January of 1959, for the first time in nearly a century, Pope John XXIII called for an ecumenical council to reevaluate church policy, doctrine, and practice. The findings of this council, which would come to be known as Vatican II, would go on to shape the history of the Catholic Church for more than half a century afterward.
But before Vatican II could begin in earnest, Pope John XXIII gathered several priests and laymen together to share their own ideas. Thanks to his success as a legislator and Catholic writer, Plinio Cojeira de Oliveira traveled to Rome in 1959 to give his input.
What Oliveira found was a church that seemed hell-bent on abandoning his conservative attitudes. In spite of feverish campaigning and multiple petitions on his part, Oliveira discovered that the Vatican wasn't receptive to his traditionalist philosophy.
As Oliveira sensed that the church was slipping away from his own ideals, he increased his literary output back home. His writing became more uncompromising as he emphasized that his political beliefs, and only his political beliefs, were the right and true stance for any Catholic.
In an effort to push back against the church's progression and advance his own ideology, Oliveira published the most influential of his books, 1959's Revolution and Counter-Revolution.
As the title implies, the book expounded on the failures of revolution and the necessity of counter-revolution.
According to 51-year-old Oliveira, revolution was an inherently progressive ideal, and revolutionary values included democracy, equality, the advancement of science, improved quality of life for all, and the construction of a great utopia.
To an average person, all of these concepts probably sound good and virtuous, but Oliveira argued that the only being capable of bringing about goodness was God himself. If any human tried to shape the world for the better, they were usurping God's authority and damning themselves and the wider world through their efforts.
According to Oliveira, the only ethical response to the march of revolution was to establish a counter-revolution. Christian counter-revolutionaries opposed communism, enforced a strict caste system along racial, gendered, and socioeconomic lines, and resisted scientific study and development.
In fact, Oliveira argued that a counter-revolutionary's ultimate goal was to bring the world back to a medieval-style society. He even felt violent militancy was justifiable in halting progressivism and turning the clock back to a more regressive era.
As he explained in the book, one of the very important parts of counter-revolutionary work is to teach a love for inequality and for moral law and purity.
Revolution and Counter-Revolution sold 56,000 copies throughout South America. Oliveira's narrative found a particularly friendly audience in Spanish-speaking clergy in Spain and Latin America.
But Oliveira's arguments didn't resonate with everybody. He hadn't expected them to. In his mind, the world and the church itself was already corrupted by utopian revolutionary ideals. But he found a small group of true believers who proved utterly loyal to his arguments and to himself. These fellow devotees could serve as a holy community within the church, with Oliveira as their head.
From there, the next step was clear. He had to institute his own feudal society to preserve his conservative Christian values. When the apocalypse came, his followers would be the ones to initiate Christ's millennial kingdom.
And in the meanwhile, he'd continue to advance his beliefs and try to court new recruits. Whether he was destined to change the world for the better, or if he'd ride out the apocalypse to rule in the end times, Oliveira was convinced that he alone was tasked with serving God's purpose.
It was a purpose he was willing to fight for, and, if necessary, kill.
Coming up, Oliveira's ideals are fulfilled through tradition, family, property. Now back to the story.
In 1959, after a lifetime spent trying to influence the Catholic Church through politics and his regular newspaper columns, 50-year-old Plinio Cojeiro de Oliveira published Revolutions and Counter-Revolutions. The highly influential screed warned against the evils of progressivism and the necessity for the church to return to a Dark Ages mentality.
Spurred by his literary success, in 1960, he founded Tradition Family Property as an offshoot of the Catholic Church. Its title stemmed from his ideas of what a true Catholic's main value should be: traditions, family, and the ownership of property.
Oliveira saw his efforts as more important than ever. Tradition Family Property, or TFP, was founded right on the heels of the Communist Revolution in Cuba. And in 1960, Oliveira's home nation of Brazil elected Jânio Quadros, a progressive, as president.
Oliveira feared that his nation was inextricably turning down a revolutionary path, and he alone had the vision to stop it. He had to commit everything he had to his cause, which meant he'd never marry, never father children, and never live an ordinary life. All of his efforts were poured directly into TFP.
In its original form, TFP was an advocacy organization that operated within the pre-existing Catholic structure. Loosely affiliated TFP members attended political events to distribute anti-abortion literature or push back against what they perceived to be insidious communist agendas. They vehemently opposed agricultural reforms designed to improve the lives of poor farmers.
TFP operated summer schools and camps for young boys. The classes taught by TFP leaders and their wives covered topics like religion, politics, and culture. They regularly incorporated medieval imagery into the classroom.
Ostensibly, these youth outreach efforts provided important structure and opportunities to Brazil's at-risk youth. In practice, these programs were perfect for indoctrinating potential recruits.
As Oliveira continued to run schools, sell books, and see his ideas spread, he watched the Catholic Church turn in exactly the direction he'd warned against.
Pope John XXIII's groundbreaking ecumenical council lasted for 3 years, from 1962 to 1965. The council, known as Vatican II, soon launched a massive theological overhaul, issuing 16 separate documents advising changes to church practices and doctrine.
Among other new policies, Vatican II permitted priests to lead Mass in their native languages after over a millennium of exclusively Latin services. They allowed Catholic priests to hold joint worship services with Protestants, and they laid the groundwork for cooperation and collaboration with non-Christian faiths.
To many outside observers, Vatican II represented a new willingness on the Vatican's part to adapt to a changing ecumenical world.
Oliveira wasn't one of those outside observers. In fact, he attended a few sessions of the Ecumenical Council, but left early in disgust when he realized that the Vatican was committed to liberation theology.
As a result, the new doctrines were crafted almost entirely without his input.
Once the resolutions became public, Oliveira refused to accept them. In fact, he found the entire referendum to be heretical. Prior to that point, Oliveira had gladly served on Catholic organizations.
But in the early aftermath of Vatican II, he became increasingly critical of the Pope and other Catholic authorities.
Oliveira now saw the organization of the Catholic Church as one of his enemies, and he was equally vigilant against the creeping spread of secularism throughout the world. In 1966, TFP launched an effort called First Campaign to Prevent the Destruction of the Family, a nationwide anti-divorce initiative.
That same decade, 58-year-old Oliveira began taking trips with his TFP supporters across borders. He was determined that TFP would be a multinational organization, and he knew that he'd find like-minded allies outside of Brazil.
Like a weed with an underground network of roots, TFP spread through Latin America and Europe, popping up in unexpected places. From the outside, few could have spotted the connections between the various TFP members, especially as international branches adopted new names, leading them to appear to be entirely distinct from one another.
Oliveira was never able to court large crowds or massive numbers of converts. He didn't need to. His beliefs appealed to people like himself, wealthy, privileged, conservative men with government ties. Oliveira didn't need the numbers when he had access to policymakers who could single-handedly shape legislation.
In 1968, Oliveira ramped up his efforts. That year, the 59-year-old began distributing materials accusing the church of being infected by the spread of communism. Across four countries, he was able to collect over 2 million signatures on a petition to launch a purge of the church.
On March 14, 1971, 62-year-old Oliveira published a scathing article with Folha de São Paulo. In it, he wrote, "There is a class of heresiarchs and heretics who don't rush out of the church but wish instead to stay inside, fishing in muddy waters. It is necessary to root them out by sheer force through the application of spiritual penalties."
His paranoid claims, coupled with multiple publications criticizing what Oliveira saw as the Pope's capitulation to progressive forces, made Oliveira's stance clear. He saw the Vatican as an enemy of God.
Ironically, Oliveira still had strong ties to the church, and he still believed he could reform it from within. The Vatican, in turn, remained eager to cooperate with Oliveira, especially given that he had the resources and the reach to continue to help elevate their own political standing.
Meanwhile, Oliveira's lifestyle continued to more closely resemble his philosophies. He adorned his personal property with medieval banners. He declared that his land would operate like a Middle Ages estate, with himself as the unquestioned lord. His employees and anyone else who came to his property would have to be supplicant to him. By the late 60s, a small number of young men began arriving at Oliveira's fief. Most of these men were recent graduates of the TFP-run schools and camps. After spending their teenage years learning TFP values, they now wanted to commit to the cause.
Reporter Matt Davis noted that most cult recruitment processes work very differently from that of tradition family property. Typically, cult members will downplay their religious beliefs and instead provide a sense of community to lonely or socially unstable targets. Only once a person is firmly enmeshed in the cult society do they learn of the theological underpinnings.
But Oliveira's earliest followers knew exactly what he was preaching, and they willingly committed to the cause. They saw themselves as warriors for God, who would replace the Catholic Church as the one true religion. All they had to do was prepare to survive the coming apocalypse.
In keeping with his own fascination with medieval society, Oliveira ordered his earliest followers to serve him unquestioningly, much as a serf would have worked for his master.
Oliveira cemented his authority by hearkening back to his privileged childhood. He emphasized a belief in the divine right of kings, or the stance that God preordained certain people to be born into authority because they were fated to be leaders. His family ties cemented his feudal legitimacy, while his more disadvantaged followers were doomed to remain serfs forever.
Researcher Tariq Abdulkrim Alwertan with the Journal of Values-Based Leadership explored the impacts of nepotism in business environments. He found that some people objected to what they perceived as unfair treatment, but in communities with ingrained values of inherited authority, nepotism was actually viewed favorably as a useful tool to strengthen the community.
In Oliveira's case, he argued that because he had noble blood, he had a birthright claim to noble titles within TFP.
As for his common-born followers, they were expected to know their place and willingly serve Oliveira with no expectation of promotion.
It may sound strange to think that anyone would voluntarily submit themselves to a feudal lord's unquestioned authority. But these young men, already brainwashed into believing that their poverty made them lesser people, wholeheartedly committed to their new roles. They even chose to identify as volunteers rather than as followers or recruits.
As for new recruits who came from a wealthy or privileged background, Oliveira permitted them to retain their status within TFP. They too bought lands that they ruled, while still submitting to Oliveira's authority as the head of the movement.
In exchange for their privileged roles, those volunteers provided much-needed financial backing for the movement.
Oliveira emphasized that only men were allowed to serve him, because only they had the authority and the physical fitness to wage the coming battle against the Antichrist. All TFP volunteers, as well as Oliveira, took lifelong vows of celibacy. Exceptions were made for already married and wealthy recruits.
He required his volunteers to train military style every day. Although they were permitted and encouraged to take communion in Catholic churches, his recruits could not attend worship services.
All new recruits were required to severely limit the amount of time they spent speaking with their family. When a newcomer's parents pushed for a face-to-face visit, he was only permitted to repeat TFP slogans and then end the conversation within an hour.
Central to life within tradition family property was the sacrament of confession, and supplicants were regularly pushed and prodded to be more detailed as they described their sinful behavior.
Oliveira was designing a world in which he was supreme leader, a dominion brought completely under his control. This need for total control likely made him feel secure and fed his previously discussed self-image.
In addition to ruling as a lord, Oliveira adopted other medieval-inspired affectations. He hosted regular jousts. He had a banner designed with TFP's sigil, a golden lion rampant on a red field. This iconography was displayed throughout his property.
Most importantly, Oliveira emphasized to his followers that they had to be committed to TFP above all else.
He warned them that in the coming revolution, they'd have to abandon all ties to their old lives that stood in the way of their devotion to Christ. According to Oliveira, many TFP militants would begin the battle by murdering their own families. Any man who killed his own father and mother would be rewarded by God.
TFP members had to attend strict training sessions where they used photographs of the Pope for target practice. He warned that very soon, the Pope would be killed for his impiety. His volunteers needed to be prepared for the violent fallout from that death.
All the training, all the devotion, all of the isolation, all was in preparation for the apocalypse. Oliveira was certain that they wouldn't all survive to the end, but he was resolved to bring as many of his followers to Christ's second coming as he could.
Ultimately, he saw his men not as religious followers or as adherents. They were an army, and a war was coming.
Thanks again for tuning into Cults. We'll be back with another episode next Tuesday, in which we'll further explore how Oliveira's fanaticism grew increasingly violent.
For more information on Plinio Cojeiro de Oliveira and tradition family property, amongst the many sources we used, we found his book Revolution and Counter-Revolution, as well as Roberto de Matteis' The Crusader of the 20th Century, Plinio Cojeiro de Oliveira, extremely helpful to our research.
You can find all episodes of Cults and all other podcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Cults, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Cults on Spotify, just open the app and type Cults in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Cults was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Russell Nash, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. This episode of Cults is written by Angela Jorgensen and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson.